Welcome to Side Streets, a podcast about the history and geography of London. I'm Alan Hertz, Professor Emeritus of Humanities at Hult International Business School. Despite my accent, I've been prowling London and learning about its past for over 40 years. Side Streets is a Black Lab Media production, and my producer and editor is Wilhelm Schenk. This is the second part of three developments about housing estates around Whitecross Street. If you haven't listened to the first part, you should probably do that before tackling this one. Last time we finished with the post-war reconstruction of Peabody Town, but the thousands of incendiary bombs that dropped on that night in December 1940 didn't just devastate the Peabody estate, they wrecked the whole area. That night, the wonderfully named Sir Aylmer Firebrace, Inspector-in-Chief of the London Fire Services, was at Red Cross Street Fire Station, which itself had to be evacuated. He later described the scene. The high wind which accompanies conflagrations is now stronger than ever, and the air is filled with a fierce driving rain of red-hot sparks and burning brands. The clouds overhead are a rose pink from the reflected glow of the fires, and fortunately, it is bright enough to pick our way eastward down 4th Street. Here fires are blazing on both sides of the road. Burnt out and abandoned fire appliances lie smoldering in the roadway, the rubber tires completely melted. The rubble from collapsed buildings lying 3 and 4 feet deep makes progress difficult in the extreme. Scrambling and jumping, we use the bigger bits of masonry as stepping stones and eventually reach the outskirts of the stricken area. The fires left little of use behind. According to Elaine Harwood, whose book on the Golden Lane estate is both authoritative and beautiful, in the square of land between Fan and Hatfield Street, Goswell Road and Golden Lane, only one building survived. The rest of the site became a dumping ground for rubble cleared from the surrounding streets. When the war ended, the City of London authorities set about reconstruction. And like Hook and Wren after the Great Fire, they saw an opportunity as well as an emergency. A chance not just to rebuild, but to create a new modern London. The ruins of Whitecross Street became a social engineering laboratory, and that square of land, that dumping ground for local rubble, became the site of a pioneering experiment. In 1951, the site was not in fact in the City of London, but in the borough of Finsbury. The boundary has since been moved, and even Finsbury has been absorbed into Islington, but the city had long built social housing outside its own jurisdiction, since land within the square mile was frighteningly expensive. So the city bought the land, planned and paid for the development. It did so with two explicit objectives: to begin the process of physical reconstruction in a way that would create a model for the future, and to provide local housing to entice workers that the recovering city desperately required. For example, prospective City of London policemen and medical staff at St. Bartholomew's Hospital just up the road. Let me dwell on this. At a time of unprecedented, desperate housing shortage, the Golden Lane estate was not built for those most in need. It was not even built for those in need locally in Finsbury, an area with a large population of very large working-class Irish families. Rather, it was intended as a magnet to draw key workers back into the center of town. The peculiarly Victorian pattern I discussed last time, the Peabody Trust helping not those who needed housing most, but those who met certain minimum standards of respectability and reliability, those with economic or social value, that pattern turns out to be not peculiarly Victorian at all. It still flourished in the second half of the 20th century, and of course, we should all admit, with some embarrassment, that it still flourishes today. After some debate about what exactly should be built and how densely populated the new development should be, an open competition was set up to choose a design. The briefer entrants included a community center, a pub, and shops. This was not going to be merely blocks of flats. It was going to be a planned, coherent, largely self-sufficient neighborhood. but it was a neighborhood designed for singles and young families. Balconies were to be large enough to park a pram, and there would be a playground, but only a handful of flats would have more than two bedrooms, and there was no space for a school. The large families of Finsbury would have to find shelter elsewhere. 178 designs were submitted, including one each from three teachers of architecture at the Kingston School of Art, Peter Chamberlain, Jeffrey Powell, and Christoph Bonn. They had made a pact. If any of their entries was chosen, they would all quit their jobs, set up in business together, and build the winning design. Powell's scheme triumphed, and the trio founded Chamberlain, Powell, and Bonn, CPB, which was responsible not only for Golden Lane, but also for the Barbican. Thus they did, I think, as much to shape the look and layout of central London as anyone since Wren and Hawke. Like the new Peabody Estate just to its north, the Golden Lane Estate combines high and low-rise development. But it has a very different atmosphere. For example, CPB had an interesting and innovative approach to security. The layout of their buildings encouraged outsiders to cross the estate. The theory was that people walking through on a regular basis would notice and inhibit unusual criminal or antisocial activity. Whereas the geography of Peabody Estates repels outsiders, the Golden Lane Estate invites them in. My listeners who know the Barbican must wonder what happened to that openness. Be patient, we'll get there soon. CPB's response to post-war chaos was even more imaginative. Rather than spend time and money clearing and leveling the site before building, they adapted the cellars of ruined buildings for car parking and a swimming pool and incorporated mounds of rubble into their landscaping. But they looked forward as well as back, embracing new building materials in a startlingly wide range of colors to give individual buildings each a distinctive character and the whole development a very modern look. The estate is charmingly full of quirks: ornamental ponds, exposed staircases, a roof garden, a small fortress constructed of rubble. Crescent House, which runs along Goswell Street, elegantly follows the road's long curve while maintaining a rigorous rectangularity. It literally squares the circle, a miracle of geometry. The estate also embodies a philosophy of planning that was certainly new at the time. Powell himself put it well. There is no attempt at the informal in these courts. We regard the whole scheme as urban. We have no desire to make the project look like a garden suburb. In other words, CPB were rejecting the suburban aesthetic of places like, well, the residential streets of the Kingston they had left behind. Instead, they were inspired by the modernist machine for living of Le Corbusier, but also by the traditional shared courtyards of Italian and Spanish cities. The Golden Lane Estate remains a much sought-after place to live, with architects and designers now making up a large fraction of the residents. In 1997, the buildings were listed Grade 2 and 2-star as of great architectural importance, and they've also won a Housing Design Award. The estate was seen as a significant success at the time, too. It appeared in newsreels and even had a documentary made about it by the Rank organization. It may not have solved or even addressed London's most urgent housing crisis, but as intended, it was a model for residential developments elsewhere. So the city authorities knew where to turn when they embarked on the largest of their post-war redevelopments. Let's leave Golden Lane, walk down to the south end of Whitecross Street, and confront the Barbican. Like many Londoners who love the arts, I have spent decades hating the Barbican. Several of the most powerful aesthetic experiences of my life have happened at the Arts Center, but they've happened in spite of the place. Getting there, getting to my seat, getting to the toilets or the bar at the interval, getting home afterwards have involved adventures worthy of Odysseus. So as I prepared for this episode, I was enormously relieved to discover that the Arts Center was not originally meant to cater for London as a whole. The original brief included a community center for residents, but only after most of the estate was built did the city decide to expand that community center to be a rival for the South Bank, to be the home of the Royal Shakespeare Company, the London Symphony Orchestra, to be the main London stopping point for international touring superstars of theater and classical music. And by the time that decision, which would bring thousands and thousands of people to the heart of the Barbican every year, was taken, CPB had already designed the estate to embody a completely different relationship with non-residents from that of Golden Lane. The Barbican is intentionally a fortress repelling outsiders, a labyrinth bewildering those who breach its outer defenses, and an Alice in Wonderland environment of irresistibly attractive places which those invaders cannot reach, let alone enter. It was meant to be thrilling to live in, but not to travel through or to visit. I'm not sure I can explain, let alone justify their approach, but in the rest of this episode, I will try. In 1945, only three buildings were standing in the 35 acres, 14 hectares, of what is now the Barbican Estate. In the census of 1951, only 48 people were recorded as living there. The area was utterly desolate and desperately needed reconstruction and repopulation. The City of London authorities approached Chamberlain, Powell, and Bohn, already at work on Golden Lane, to create something much bigger and very different. Once again, the city was not building for those in need. In fact, this time it was not building even for key workers who might not otherwise be able to afford city rents. The Barbican was created as a luxury development for modern young professionals. The target market was famously described as likely to have a taste for Mediterranean holidays, French food, and Scandinavian design. A flat in the Barbican was presented as an alternative to part of a house in Chelsea or Chiswick. You might not get a garden, but you would get a shorter commute, a modern, even futuristic apartment with all the latest tech, a large community of like-minded people, an extraordinarily interesting neighborhood to explore, great views, and an address with significant social cachet. This mission explains the intimidating, unwelcoming face turned by the Barbican to the world beyond it. The development was meant to be exclusive, and being exclusive necessarily involves exclusion. It wasn't cheap either. The rents were competitive with mansion flats in Kensington, and the service charges were just as high, and I gather are nowadays even higher. To sum up, the Barbican was in no sense meant as social housing. CPB were invited to build utopia for yuppies. One key feature of the brief had an enormous impact on the design. At the time, the city authorities had a delightfully idealistic but utterly unrealistic plan for the reconstruction of the entire city. Wheeled transport and pedestrians would move on different levels. Cars, trucks, buses would be down there on streets. Walkers would be up here on pedways. And CPB was required to make the Barbican conform. Pedways were abandoned as unworkable, but only after the Barbican was half built. And just as CPB had brilliantly turned the ruins and craters of Golden Lane into design features, so the pedways of the city's grand plan became an inspiration rather than a constraint. Barbican residents would live in a brutalist Bruges, a Venice without canals, a network of alleys, bridges, and staircases, a place to be explored every day on the way to work or school or the corner shop, a place without exhaust fumes, don't walk signs, or traffic. And it works. If you're walking through the Barbican knowing where you are going, If you are not in a rush to get to your seat before the show starts, if you're strolling home from school or work, there are endless delights. Greenery glimpsed at the end of a long arcade, balconies shaped like Venetian gondolas, music school windows framed by gigantic tuning forks, most of all, constantly changing and contrasting textures of chiseled, hammered, polished concrete. The Barbican's concrete is infamous. What a shock to discover that it was not a feature of the original design. To begin with, the buildings were going to be faced in white. Ceramic tiles, marble, mosaics. The facade of the old Museum of London gives a hint of what might have been. But acres of marble proved far too expensive, and CPB came up with their extraordinary alternative. Textured concrete. This was not a straightforward choice. Most of the surfaces had to be finished by hand after they were in place and the concrete was dry. This required skilled workers and a lot of time. And CPB did not employ one texture, but dozens. Hidden behind a door off a ramp to the underground car park is an amazing vertical catalog, a wall displaying dozens of samples of different mixtures and treatments and finishes of concrete. And the final product is amazing, too. The Barbican, if you have time to look at it, is a subtle symphony of gray, a complex meditation on a single color worthy of Whistler or maybe Rothko. Many of the Barbican's most visible features were likewise the product of second thoughts and changing circumstances. CPB were great improvisers. The Botanical Garden was created to conceal the fly tower of the theater. Itself a late addition. The amphitheater to the north of the Art Center is really the roof of the concert hall, another late addition. The lake at the heart of the complex covers the Metropolitan line, which runs so close to the surface that it couldn't be built on. There's only a meter of water, which is dyed green to look deeper. The bridge which crosses it is another late addition. The original, unworkable plan was to have an arterial road in a suspended tunnel. I've never been inside a Barbican flat, but I have seen pictures, and CPB were as imaginative on the inside as they were on the outside. The estate is gigantic, over 2,000 flats, housing over 4,000 people. The range of accommodation is enormous, from studio flats to three-story tower-top penthouses to a row of five-bedroom muse houses with garages and private terraces, and the internal decoration was as elegant and up-to-date as the time allowed. The layouts were open plan, with big windows, fitted shelves, underfloor heating. The door handles, light switches, and wash basins were custom designed. The kitchens had built-in refrigerators and double basin sinks with disposal units. How could those yuppies resist? One problem was that the huge estate took so long to build. By the time it was completed in the 1980s, fashions had changed. Large-scale developments, brutalist architecture, tower blocks were all much less attractive than they had been 30 years before. And of course, people continue to get lost on their way to the plays and concerts at the Arts Center. So unlike Golden Lane, the Barbican has never been a model for developers. It is unique. But spending time there has been a series of small revelations. I could go on for much longer about the subtleties of the design and the wit and inventiveness of the details, but I don't want to outstay my welcome, and I do want to take a moment to look back over our exploration of the area as a whole. For most of London's history, Whitecross Street has been on the edge of town, and much of what happened here exemplifies the idea of edginess that I introduced in our first season. Cemeteries require space, and space is hard to find at a city center. Jews and Quakers, outsiders as they are, can be buried on the fringe. Theaters and breweries were also well placed here, the former to avoid close regulation, the latter to get easy access to water and other raw materials. Social housing, too, made sense here. Land was cheap, but access to work in the center of town was relatively easy. Golden Lane is a great example. By the time the Barbican was built and Whitbread's brewery closed, London had expanded enormously. The site was now central, not peripheral, more difficult to reach with a lorry full of barley, but more suitable to house bankers eager to avoid a long ride from the suburbs. Geography does much to shape history, but the depth and range of human activity in this marginal area has fascinated me, as I hope it has interested you. Well, that's enough for now. Thanks for listening. Next time, we'll go back a few centuries and look at the founding of London by the Romans. What was here before they arrived? Why did they put a settlement here? What was that early settlement like? This episode was researched, written, and presented by me, Alan Hertz. Side Streets is a Black Lab Media production, and my producer and editor is Wilhelm Schenk.